Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Chapter 13. I guess y'all all know that. No. I'm sorry. I meant to take those verses out because I'm just go ahead and skip to the introduction if you would. Sorry about that, folks. Because what we're going to do, if you'll turn to chapter 13, we'll just follow along as we make our way through this text. Does everybody know who Alexander Solzhenitsyn is? That's a mouthful. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was a man who knew how to hang on to hope, and that's what I've entitled this message, Hanging on to Hope. As a political prisoner in Russia, for many years he became an icon of perseverance through suffering for the cause of freedom. He was forced to work 12 hours a day at hard labor and had to exist on a starvation diet. Because of that, he became seriously ill, and the doctors predicted that he wouldn't live much longer. One afternoon, he just stopped working. Even though he knew that the guards would beat him severely, he just couldn't go on any longer. He was so exhausted. Well, at that precise moment, another prisoner, a fellow Christian, approached him, and with his cane, the man drew a cross in the sand and quickly erased it. Instantly, Solzhenitsyn felt all the hope of God flood his soul. In the midst of his despair, that emblem of hope where Christ won the victory over sin gave Solzhenitsyn the courage to endure that difficult day and the grueling months of imprisonment that lie before him. And when we hang on to hope, and his life proves that, when we hang on to hope, we can endure anything. Job, much like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, was also a man who underwent an excruciating trial in a hopeless situation. His spirits were sinking lower and lower, and death seemed to be his only way out. But in the midst of his despair, his soul was suddenly strengthened with hope, a renewed hope in God, when Job said, "Though he slay me, yet I will hope in him." And despite his agony, he found new hope in God and restored confidence in a positive future. So hanging on to this hope kept Job from going when he just wanted to give up. As you all recall, I hope, last week, John pointed out that in chapters 12 through 14, we have by far Job's longest speech, and it brings to a close the first series of speeches between Job and his friends. From chapters 12:1 through chapter 13:19, Job speaks directly to his three friends. And in chapter 13, verse 20, down through the last verse of chapter 14, he speaks directly to God. And from 13:20 through the end of chapter 14, that's what he does. He speaks directly to God. And it's in those three chapters that we will see Job begin to make some real progress in his thinking about his worldview and the theological system that he and his three friends had shared and clung to for so long, especially where God's sovereignty is concerned and about the fact that sin, them believing that sin is the cause of all suffering. In the previous chapter, chapter 12, Job was speaking to his friends. And as he does, he begins to get a little bit of clarification in his mind about their shared theological views of God's sovereignty, mainly that what he believed up until he was afflicted, now get this, what he believed up until he was afflicted is not working for him any longer. It's just not working. Because, as one commentator points out, first, it's cruel. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 6. Second, it's shallow. Chapter 12, verses 7 through 12. Third, it's tame. Chapter 12, verses 13 through 25. And last, it's deceitful. And we see that in this chapter, chapter 13, verses 1 through 12. And it's here in chapter 13, verses 13 through 19, that Job seriously begins to consider taking his case to God. He starts to consider that if he ever expects to get any real answers to his dilemma, because he's certainly not getting any answers from his friends. And that's what he does. In chapter 13, verses 20 through 22, Job takes the deepest longings of his heart, which is to argue his case with God. So he takes it to God because he knows that God is the only one that can give him any real answers to his dilemma. However, he recognizes that he might have a sin problem in verses 23 through 27. And then in 28, it seems as though Job falls back into his depressed state. But we'll deal with that when we get to it. In this chapter, Job continues his reply to what Zophar said in chapter 11. You remember him. He was the most sarcastic of the three friends. But in actuality, Job is replying to all three of his friends with his thoughts on what they all had said to him thus far. So it's not just Zophar he's speaking to. He's speaking to all of them. And everything that he says in chapters 12, 13, and 14 is a broad and comprehensive expose on the bankruptcy of their shared theological system. Most specifically, that because God is sovereign, anything bad that happens, happens because God makes it happen. Now, Job begins this chapter as a witness to his own testimony when he says, "Behold, my eye has seen all this, my ear has heard and understood it," in verse 1. Now, although Job's friends treated him like an idiot, And Zophar called him an idiot over in chapter 11. Even though they considered him an idiot, Job understood God's intervention in the lives of people and nations. And he says, I know, listen, guys, I know what you know. I know it too. I'm not inferior to you. They were clearly not his superiors, certainly not in wisdom or insight. But as far as, now this blew my mind the first time I read this. As far as they were concerned, he was nothing but a sinner, deserving much worse than what he had been dealt by God. And you see that in chapter 11, verse 6. Zophar says it. You didn't get everything you deserved. Then in chapter 12, verses 13 through 25, Job has given a vivid description of the wisdom, power, and sovereignty of God and makes it known to his friends. Now listen, he makes it known to his friends that he is just as sound and clear has just as sound a clear an understanding of the attributes of God as they did. He wasn't inferior to them about the nature and the character of God. But there is something else that Job is beginning to understand. Something about their shared belief system that's beginning to really bug him. I don't know how long it's been bothering him, but it must have been for some time. Everything that he has believed before, it's just not adding up now. Something is wrong. Something is amiss. And because it is, that's why I think he wants to have his day in court with God. Job is innocent. He knows he's innocent, yet from all the outward appearance, and according to their shared belief system, their belief system being that suffering is always the result of sin, it appears to Job's friends that since God has taken all his possessions, his servants, his livestock, his children, and afflicted him with this horrible disease, then he has to be guilty of some kind of hidden sin. But Job knows he's innocent, and that he also knows he has no unconfessed sin in his life. So think about it a minute. God knows he's innocent. Job knows he's innocent. Hey, even Satan knows he's innocent. Everybody knows he's innocent but his three friends. And yet, here he is suffering as though he were guilty. And none of this squares with the God that Job believes in. Which is why he doesn't want to argue with his friends any longer. He just wants to take his case before God. Now, can you imagine for a moment being in the situation that he's in, how thoroughly confused he must be? He has to be. If he's righteous, and he is, we know he is because God said he was in chapter 1 and 2. So if he's righteous, well, why has all these calamities fallen on him? So Job says in verse 3, "But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue with God." In other words, hey, Zophar, Bildad, Eliphaz, I don't want to argue with you guys any longer. I want to argue with God in court. In court with God is the only place that this is going to get resolved. You say I'm guilty. I say I'm not. So let's see what God says. His friends have all but said that he's no smarter than a jackass. They've all been sarcastic and mean-spirited, especially Zophar, calling him a lying blowhard. Listen now. Listen to how cruel he's been to Job. He's called him a lying blowhard, a wicked, guilty, unrepentant sinner, a boastful hypocrite. And he said all that in chapter 11. So now Job makes it clear, hey, you don't know. I know as much as you do. You're not one bit better than I am. And when it comes to God, his perfections, his sovereignty, his holiness, his justice, his wisdom, his power, his goodness, his working in providence, and his dealing with men in an ordinary and in an extraordinary way, I know as much, if not more, than you do. You have no reason. Guys, you have no reason to talk down to me the way you have. I am not the liar that you have accused me of being. So please, just shut up. Shut up so I can concentrate what I'm going to say to God when I do appear before him. Job's three miserable comforters have been no comfort or encouragement to Job, not in the least. They won't take him at his word or accept his plea of innocence. In fact, they have lied to him and about him. Remember, I just mentioned it a while ago. Zophar called him a liar in chapter 11. Now let's look at what Job says in verse 4 as he turns on them and he says, "As for you, you smear me with lies." Zophar had smeared him with lies. You see it in verse 3 of chapter 11. And now Job retaliates, calling Zophar a liar. Now, saints, calling someone you consider a friend, and yet when I'm wondering how he considers them friends, the way they've talked to him and acted towards him, but he does. But calling someone you consider a friend a liar, that can't be taken lightly. It's a hard and harsh accusation. But they had provoked Job's passions. So much so, he strikes back with the same charge against them. Now, I know, because I've been in this situation before, it's not unusual that while discussing something that you're passionate about or that's controversial, for things to get heated up and out of hand. And rather than staying on point, men tend to start calling one another names. They resort to what's called ad hominems. An ad hominem is directed against the person rather than the position that they embrace and argue for. So it can really get heated up. And people's feelings can really be hurt. Saying things contrary to the grace of God, the likes of which redeemed men should never allow themselves to indulge in. Job is innocent. He's maintained his innocence, but the evidence combined with their bad theology tells his friends that he's guilty. A theology Job held to before he was afflicted, but Job's not so sure anymore. He's having serious doubts. Things are just not adding up, especially in light of his circumstances. So I hope we'll eventually be able to see how God used his suffering and his circumstances for God's glory and to cause Job to grow in his knowledge of God. At this point, waiting on an audience with God is extremely important to Job. In fact, it's so important that he takes it up again in verses 13 through 19. But before he does, he has one last thing to say about their shared system of belief. Basically, he says, it can't be true. It can't be. Why? Because not all suffering is a result of sin, and Job's suffering is not the result of unconfessed sin, and he knows it. You won't believe me. You smear me with lies. But I'm not suffering because of unconfessed sin. Pastor Ash made this observation about Job's comment. He said, Job accuses them, his friends, of whitewashing the messy reality of the world with a shallow coat of systematic white paint to make it look tidy, so he calls them worthless physicians. In other words, you're a bunch of know-nothing quacks who have no clue as to what you're doing. Many of their ideas about God were true. They were. But they didn't apply to Job's situation. They were right about God being just. They were right to say that God punishes sin. But they were wrong to assume that Job's suffering was a just punishment for his sin. In other words, they took a true principle and applied it wrongly ignoring the vast differences in human circumstances. Their medicine for Job's condition just made his condition that much worse. It was the gospel medicine that Job needed to hear, was it? They gave Job a wrong diagnosis. We must be careful and compassionate in how we apply biblical condemnations to others. But now Job is so flustered with his friends, he says, "Oh, that you would be completely silent and that it would become your wisdom. Please hear my argument and listen to the contentions of my lips." The nearest thing to wisdom for them would for them to just be silent. Sometimes the wisest thing we can do is to keep our mouths shut. His friends had been silent during the first week that they had been with Job, chapter 2, verse 13. And he noted that it would be wisdom for them to be quiet again. And that is wisdom. The less you say, my friends, the better. Pleading for his friends to hear and listen to him. Verse 6, Job prepared to ask 6 rhetorical questions in which he challenged the competency of his friends to offer counsel as though they were speaking for God. First question Job asks says, "Well, will you speak what is unjust for God?" And then he asks, "And speak what is deceitful for him?" You know, saying that you're speaking for God is serious enough. That's serious business. That is serious, but it's far more serious to misrepresent God with wickedness and deceit by attributing to him actions and words that are distortions of the truth. These are serious charges Job is bringing against his friends. They claim to be standing up for God, but they were doing so without truth. They were trying to defend God with lies and making dishonest arguments in their attempt to defend him, as if God needed their defense. My goodness, trying to defend God is like trying to defend a lion. A lion doesn't need your help. All you got to do is unlock the cage and let him loose. God doesn't need us to come to his defense. He needs us to be honest with his word. Further, in verse 8, Job asks, "Well, will you show partiality for him? Will you contend for God?" Now, I've been in a lot of debates, believe it or not. And some people say anything to try to make their point in trying to protect God, trying to protect God's character and nature. It's ludicrous, but it happens all the time. As far as Job was concerned, his so-called comforters viewed themselves as God's prosecuting attorneys, showing partiality as they attempted to argue the case for God. My goodness, what proud presumption they had. How arrogant they were, believing God had appointed them for this and using them to destroy Job. Arrogance of the worst kind. And in reality, these questions reveal Job's desire for them to remain neutral, but instead they were slanting their testimony in God's favor in an attempt to paint him in a good light. God would never have us do such a thing, saints. God doesn't need us to do those sort of things, but I see it happen all the time. We may want to come to God's defense, but again, he doesn't need us to defend him. He can defend himself, wouldn't you say? So Job continues with his last two questions. When he says, "Will it be well when he examines you?" I don't know about you, but that question would have made me a little bit uneasy, made me a little uncomfortable. Or will you deceive him as one deceives a man? Job wants them to think about what will happen when God finds out what they're doing. Truth is, he knows what they're doing. He wants them to know that it's impossible to deceive God. He's not like we humans. He knows every thought and intent of the human heart. If they were defendants in court with God, they would never be able to withstand his examination. They would be exposed for what they are by the all-seeing eye of God, just like everyone else. Just like everyone else. And then he says to them, "You miserable comforters, it's not me who's in danger from God. It's you." He will surely reprove you if you secretly show partiality. When you are confronted, listen, guys, when you are confronted by the majestic God of the universe, will you not be terrified? Huh? Will you not? Doesn't your fear of him overwhelm you? If not, it should. And all your supposedly wise defenses of God are utterly worthless, like burnt out ashes and useless clay. And I can just picture Job sitting there on his ash heap as he spoke these words. And he may have been holding a broken piece of pottery, that piece of pottery that he used to scrape himself with. He may have been holding that broken piece of pottery, as he said, defenses of clay. Even though they were filled with prideful arrogance as they looked down on Job, he reasoned that even they would experience terror and dread before God if they had no one, no mediator, no umpire to come to their defense. So, having expressed a desire to take his case to court and defend himself before God in verse 3, he now prepares himself to face the danger in coming face to face with God. Job believes that what he is about to do is deeply dangerous. Verse 13. So he says to his friends, "Be silent before me so that I may speak. Then let come on me what may." He wants his friends to be silent and leave him alone so he can think about what he's going to say to God. Something he wants so badly. He wants this so badly that he's willing to face the consequences of angering God. But then he says, "Why should I take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hands?" In verse 14. Now, I'm not sure at all what he means when he says why he should take his flesh in his teeth. Yeah, that was a strange quote to me. But it may mean something like, well, I bite my tongue or I hold my tongue in order to brace myself for danger. I remember one time I was down at Six Flags, and they had a ride called the Cliff. This thing goes out, man, zoom, it just drops. And I look, people was like, that's what that reminds me of. Maybe that's how he felt when he knew he was going to be in the presence of God. Terrified, frightened. So he may be saying, "I know I may be placing my life in my own hands, but I'm going to say to God exactly what's on my mind. Doesn't matter how afraid I am, I'm going to say it." The risk of placing himself in jeopardy like this was one Job was willing to take, if he could prove his innocence. Why would he put himself in such jeopardy and danger? Why would he endanger his life like that in order to maintain his blameless character? Why was he willing to do that? Because while he was terrified of God, he nonetheless had an unwavering trust in him. Listen to what he says in verse 15. Though he slay me, though he slay me, I will hope in him. I love that verse. I love that verse. Even if God were to kill Job for approaching him inappropriately, he says he would still trust in God to vindicate him of all charges. And if God didn't kill Job, that would demonstrate proof, at least he believed it would, of his own blamelessness. And this stay of judgment would give him an ample opportunity to defend his ways before God. But even if God did strike him dead, he said, I will still have a strong confidence in him and his exoneration. God is going to exonerate me. Even the fear of death would not deter Job from claiming his innocence before God. Job, he knows that this is his only hope of being saved. This is his only hope of salvation. But he also knows that he is not a godless man. He knows that. Godless men cannot stand before a holy and a righteous God. And he believes in his heart of hearts that he is a godly man. Verse 16. And while he knows this is a dangerous gamble, he also knows it will pay off and be his deliverance. And unlike his friends, Job demonstrated a proper understanding of God. He knew that to enter into God's presence with unconfessed sin would be certain death for a person standing on holy ground. Not only that, but Job's willingness to plead his case before God is a strong indication that he was innocent. No one argues a case he doesn't believe he can win, do they? Now, for the third time, verse 17, in this chapter, this is the third time, Job begged for the ear of his friends. He begged for the ear of his friends in verse 6 and verse 7, 13, and now in verse 17. He asked them to listen carefully so that they could take in what he had to say since he had prepared his case in verse 18. Job had thought long and hard about what he was going to say to God in his defense, and he wants them to hear him out because he is confident. Now listen, he is confident that he's going to win in court. Look at verse 18, second part of verse 18. But his friends, like many, have you ever had a discussion with someone and you were trying to make your point and you looked them in the eyes, you could tell they were no more listening to you than they could fly. They were thinking about what they were going to say next. Well, that's probably where these guys are right here. Rather than listening, they most likely were preparing in their own minds their next argument against Job. That's the way these guys thought. They thought what they had to say was more important than what Job had to say. I preached a sermon, it's been many years ago now, but it was on the need for us to listen to one another. We owe it to one another to hear each other out. We owe it to one another. Job believed his arguments were so strong. Now listen to this. He believed his arguments were so strong that no one could possibly win against him. Look at verse 19. Then he says in the latter part of verse 19, but if someone could prove his guilt, if you can prove me guilty, then I'll shut up and just lay down and die. That's pretty well what he says. In other words, if Job was found guilty as charged, he was ready to pass away in silent shame. But He didn't believe that such an indictment could be brought against him. He thought his case was that strong. He was confident of winning. So Job's about to do something hugely significant, saints, and it's worth pausing to ask why. After all, he knows what he's about to do is dangerous. The belief system of his friends tells them that Job must have some hidden sin in his life because he's suffering. He knows it's not true. He knows he's innocent. The evidence of his eyes tells him that God is dangerous, random, and unpredictable. The faith in his heart, though, tells him that God is righteous and that he, Job, is a believer who is in a right standing with the Almighty. So knowing their belief system is not true, and despite the evidence of randomness and danger, Job's decision goes with Job's faith. And that is why he has the boldness to appeal to God. Now I think Job may just have his miserable friend's ear. Now they are silent. Now they listen as Job takes his life in his own hands and speaks to God. And as he does, he asks God two closely related things. If God will grant those two things, then Job will be able to face him. First, he asks, "Remove your heavy hand from me and let not the dread of you terrify me." Verse 21. So first, Job pleads for a brief pause in his misery. His grief and pain is so deep that he is paralyzed and weakened by it. If only God would take his hand of judgment from him for a moment, then Job could speak. Second, he says, "Summons me and I will answer, or let me speak to you and you reply," in verse 22. Pastor Ash pointed this out. He said, like Esther with the Persian king, Job longs for the golden scepter of God's grace to be extended to him. Job longs to enter the dwelling place of God and speak to him face to face. This longing to speak with the God whom Job has no doubt is responsible for all his loss and misery is kind of remarkable, isn't it? It is a sign of faith that Job in his heart of hearts so loves this God that he must speak with him. He must. Job longed for God to convene his heavenly court so that the Almighty would make his case either for him or against him. And if God would not respond, then Job requested, "Let me speak, and you reply." In other words, he would conduct his own hearing if God did not act soon. Either God would convene his court or Job would convene his own. And yet, the moment Job says this, he is deeply aware of a problem, which he explains in sequence. "How many are my iniquities and sins?" he asked. I'm not going to ask God that at all. "Make known to me my rebellion and my sin." Thank God when we stand before him, all those sins will have been covered by the blood. But Job wants God to tell him what he's done wrong. He wants him to show him his sin. He wants to know if his suffering outweighed the number of his sins. If Job only knew the number of his sins, then the sins that had caused him such pain and grief, then he could possibly accept his suffering or repent and change his life accordingly. Perhaps though, this statement shows that Job, weary and worn down, was beginning to believe his friend's accusations against him. That's a possibility. But I don't think so. Job wanted God to list the sins he had committed, which had provoked the intensity of God's affliction. And then Job turns around and says, God, why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? Will you cause a driven leaf to tremble? Or will you pursue the dry chaff? Hey, it appeared to Job that God was hiding his face from him. But in verse 20, one might get the idea that it was Job that was hiding from God. However, in these two verses, Job is wondering why God would treat him like an enemy. After all, he is no better than a leaf being blown around in the wind or a piece of chaff. Job felt that he was helpless and worthless before God, leaving him puzzled as to why God even noticed him. I've often asked myself that question, what is man that you are mindful of him? Growing in his exasperation, though, Job charges God, you write down these bitter things against me and make me inherit the sins of my youth. So what he does is he accuses God of keeping a record of his sins, like the records containing the crimes of a criminal. Job believes that he must have received a delayed sentence or something for crimes that he had committed earlier, perhaps in his youth. Even David asked that question in Psalms 25 when he says, Do not remember the sins of my youth or my transgressions? Job felt like a prisoner in solitary confinement and under strict surveillance. Back then, they didn't have ankle bracelets. So, it was as if God had fastened his feet in shackles while keeping a close watch over his path. And Job didn't feel like he could escape from God's imprisonment and his all-seeing eye. So, Job falls into despair. In verse 28, he collapses emotionally at the thought of man's final destiny, which is death and deterioration. Man wastes away like something rotten. Though through his many pains and hurts, he had learned that man is slowly decaying to nothing. And Job believes he was decomposing like a garment eaten by moths. A useless garment that would soon be just discarded and thrown away. Sometime back, the powers that be decided to build a hydroelectric dam across a valley in Maine where a small town had been situated for many years, kind of like Higdon, Arkansas, right up the road here. The people were to be relocated and the town submerged underwater, which is what happened right up the road up here. During the time between the initial decision to begin the project and the completion of the dam, this well-kept, tidy little town began to fall into disrepair. One resident explained, "Where there is no hope for the future, there is no work in the present. When hope leaves, so does the inner drive to work and endure. But when there is hope, life flourishes." And that was the same battle that raged within Job's soul. The upward pull of hope makes us confident in God's eternal purposes, especially when our circumstances reveal nothing but disorder and confusion. And it's in these difficult times that we must remain convinced that God, saints, listen, He is in control. that he rules supremely, and that he is causing all things to what? Work together for the good of those who love him. Work together for his glory and our good. This is a supreme hope of all believers, even through the darkest hours in our lives. So, how can we have hope even in the darkest times of our lives? How can we find the hope that enables us to remain strong amid our difficulties in life? How can we? Well, we can find hope by remembering several truths about trials. Here they are. One, it's God who sends trials. Did you hear me? It's God who sends trials. It was certainly the case in Job's life. His painful trial originated before the throne of God. Its source was the will of God. And so it is with us. We must remember that the supreme ruler of the universe sends trials our way according to his perfect plan for our lives. Second, God uses trials. God has a divine plan for our trials. God causes all things to work together. As Romans 8:28 makes clear, and knowing this theological truth inspires hope when we are enduring difficult times. God is always working for his glory and our good, even in the dire circumstances, and no suffering is without his purpose. Third, God controls trials. No storm in this life is ever out of control. God always defines the limits of to which a trial may go. Though it may seem otherwise, even our worst stormy ordeals remain under God's controlling hand. And listen, saints, God is never more in charge than in the midst of our trials. And last, God removes trials. No trial is without its end, at least for a believer. Weeping may last for the night, but joy comes in the morning. There will eventually come a break in our storm. According to God's perfect timing, this present trial will pass. It may be soon or it may be later. It may be in this life or it may be in the life to come, but this trial will pass. So we should have hope in God. He will eventually clear out this turbulence in our lives. Amen? Let's pray. God, we thank you that you are indeed in control, that you rule and reign supreme in your universe. And we thank you too, God, that you made us your children. And that we have the privilege of bowing before you and worshiping you for who you are. And Lord, for your children, you cause all things to work together for our good. And I just ask that you give us a desire, an overwhelming desire, Lord, to live for your glory. Amen.